Hello, everybody. Welcome to Stick to Wrestling with John McAdam and Sean Goodwin. How you doing, John?
I'm doing really good, Sean. You know, after the last show, you and I were on the phone saying, wow, you know, this hour went by rather quickly, which is always a good thing. This week went by a little bit slowly for me because I was dying to get back to this.
Absolutely, and especially with your first topic. We are going to my favorite arena in the world. I've never even been inside. I've just looked outside longingly. I love New York, and I love Madison Square Garden. There's nothing like an electric MSG crowd. It makes stars. So if you be so kind, and make sure you have all the flavor, because that's the important part of MSG, is that whole kind of vibe to the building. Tell us about your first trip to MSG. I'm envious.
Well, we went down in the summer of 82. It was the end of the summer. We went to see Bob Backlund against Playboy Buddy Rose. And, well, at least that was the main event. We were going just to go. But the cool thing about Madison Square Garden is you get on Amtrak on South Station, and it doesn't just take you to New York. It takes you to Madison Square Garden. So you don't have to, you know, take a cab or anything. And I went a total of twice. And I wish I had gone more, but at least I got to go those two times. I am an idiot because I had an opportunity to go to see the first WrestleMania in Madison Square Garden. Some ticket place up here had two good seats, not great seats, but good seats for $40. And I'm like, oh, I already bought my ticket to see it at the Worcester Centrum. I'll just stick with that. What a regret.
Who was the best match on the card?
Backlund and Rose.
Was it? I always thought there was a bad matchup between them. They did go on good together.
I thought they did a really good job in this match. Buddy Rose was a spectacular worker. I mean, he got
absolutely
in Boston a 3-star match out of Pedro Morales, which was not easy work.
I finally got around to watching one of those old Portland shows, and they just do the craziest thing. They would have it broken down into three segments, like some of them did back then. They did it in Tennessee. And what they would do between segments is have these promos, and, you know, the announcer would go through all the cards and everything like that.
Yep.
They would bring Buddy, while he's in the match, over, and he would do the promos.
Yeah, between falls, they would do promos for those matches.
It was crazy. I've never seen the actual wrestler take time out of the match to go in to do the promos right there. That's focus.
Yeah. One thing that when this show airs, I'm going to put it up. I have a WWF match between Buddy Rose and Curt Hennig. And Buddy takes, in within a 10-second period, I would say maybe 15, the three craziest bumps ever. It was like he was trying to break a leg or break an ankle.
If those two had one of those double noggin knockers in the center of the ring, they both end up in the fourth row, the way those guys bump.
One thing that got us talking about Madison Square Garden, I unearthed a show from Madison Square Garden that I had never seen before. It was from July 30th, 1983. And, you know, for me, this was a treat, something, it's like the All-Star Wrestling shows on the network. You know, I've never seen this stuff before. It's all brand new. And wanted to talk about that a little bit. They had a Jimmy Snuka versus Magnificent Morocco match. It was the first time they'd wrestled at Madison Square Garden after the big TV angle. And after 35, first of all, it was a great match. I mean, double juice. It was everything the fans wanted, just these two guys beating the crap out of each other. But secondly, you forget over time that, you know, we know, okay, the title didn't change hands, but people went into that building expecting Snuka to win the title. You could see it.
I'll say it to this day, Jimmy is still a better heel. His run in Georgia with Gordy, that was fantastic. That was him at his best. So I still prefer him as a heel, but that era right there, he was white hot as a face. And for those who don't remember, could you retell the angle that started this, the Morocco Snuka angle?
Now, as you probably know, World Class Wrestling and WWF Wrestling were aired at the same exact time. WWF was on at 11 o'clock on Channel 56 up here. World Class was on Channel 25 at 11 o'clock here. No one could just move an hour. I don't understand why. The original Saturday Night War. But the phone rings, and I pick it up, And my friend's like, you got to turn on WWF now. Don't ask questions. Just change it. So I change it, and I see Snuka outside the ring. No, Snuka's inside the ring. Morocco's out. Something had just happened, and Snuka did the dive outside the ring onto Morocco. Morocco grabs a microphone, hits Snuka in the head with it. Big bloody mess. And they had the big red X, which always makes us happy. And yeah, and oh, and then did Morocco spit on him this time? Yes, he did.
He spit on him every time.
That started the whole brawl.
That was kind of Dawn's thing. That and the meatball subs.
Ah, you beat me to it, spitting in meatball sandwiches.
Greatest moment ever. That was so well done. And if you haven't seen it, please go and see it right now. All you have to do is put down Morocco, Albano, and meatball. And I promise you it will come up. That was one of the was that an accident?
Was what the him having a meatball sub?
Oh no, I know that was on purpose, but Albano's fall.
Oh, probably not an accident. No, knowing these guys.
That was a great performance. Basically what happened was Dawn insisted on actually wrestling a match while eating a meatball sub, which he did. And he, you know, it was a, you know, jobber, and he beat the guy pretty quick. And then after the matches are walking out, Lou slips on a meatball and just goes, you know, butt over tea kettle backwards. just one of the great moments ever. I saw it with my dad for the first time a couple of weeks ago, and 30 years we're on the floor laughing. He was
awesome.
One of the great heels.
Another thing about this card, they had a match. Well, the match happened. It was Andre the Giant, Dusty Rhodes, and Ivan Putski against the Three Samoans. Now, I don't know why they did this, but they did not air this match on USA or Madison Square Garden Network. They aired it. Instead, they showed an Andre the Giant versus Big John Studd cage match from not Landover, Maryland. I think it was actually at the Cap Center in D.C. And the main event for Madison Square Garden was Bob Backlund versus George Steele. It was Backlund versus Steele was so bad that Andre versus Studd blew it away.
I didn't mind Studd. I did not mind Studd at all in the WWF. I mean, he gets a bad rap, but I thought he was pretty good. I thought he was fine against Hogan. I mean, he wasn't great, but I could buy it. You know, I could see Studd winning there. I mean, just the size, the presence he had, Heenan. I mean, that was real to me. And him and I mean, that last match, I mean, both of them, that was just too much no movement, you know, between those two. It's just, you know, too much of it. But if you put him in Studd with the right guy, then, yeah, I thought he was fine, especially in the WWF. I had no problem seeing him with the run with Hogan. Of course,
well,
I like the Schultz run, too.
Yeah, I mean, as a fan watching on television, you see this guy, and he really is huge. And because of his height, he doesn't get enough credit for, you know, his size. I mean, the guy looked like he could bench press anything he wanted to. He had big arms. But to me, Studd's only positive trait was being big. Like, that was literally it. He couldn't get, you know, I thought his interviews were terrible. He couldn't get out of his own way in the ring. So I wasn't a big fan. But yeah, him and Andre, they were moving in slow motion, but at least they were moving. And if you saw that match live, you know, you got to see everything you wanted to see. Andre bloodied up Studd, and he actually jumped off the top rope and hit like a butt drop or whatever you call it on him. And that must have been quite a sight to see live, and John Studd must have been praying down there. Meanwhile, Backlund and Steele was just awful. It was about 12 minutes of them doing the George Steele has a foreign object spot. It was just ridiculous.
You hate Steele anyway.
Yeah, but I hate Studd, too, so it all evens out.
Well, I mean, my defense with Studd would have been the fact I always liked the way he carried himself big. You have some guys who are big, like Dream Machine over in Memphis was one off the top of my head, who was huge, but he never played big. He never came across as a big guy to me. Studd, as you just said, he came across as enormous. Even, you know, even if he wasn't great in the ring, that presence kind of carried him, I thought.
Yeah, but I agree with that. My only other comment is it's kind of all he had. You know who was big and didn't get enough credit for it? Sergeant Slaughter. Like, they emphasized it on the new episodes of Mid-Atlantic Wrestling that I'm seeing on WWE Network. On that show, and WWF, they barely mentioned it. So, of course, Slaughter got over as a big guy in the Carolinas.
Well, because he was such a great bumper. I mean, that's why he was, Sarge could take a beating. I mean, you never saw big guys bump like him. I mean, if you look at that old early 80s stuff, I mean, he was flying all over the place. Even look at that crazy bump he took in the Patterson match.
Yeah.
When you do that thing into the turnbuckle and go flying on top of it, that spot. I mean, you don't see big guys doing that.
I'm trying to think of a big guy in the early 80s who was even in his league, and I really can't.
I can't think of a big guy who bumped. No, I mean, never mind in his league. I mean, first of all, Sarge, even though it was such a rarity, but, I mean, that's why you never really saw him as big, because he would take, Graham.
Superstar Billy
Graham? He wasn't quite as big, but yeah, Superstar Graham.
Yeah, actually, I have seen a Superstar Billy Graham do some big bumps. But yeah, I mean, my point is that if the WWF had pushed harder, the idea that, hey, Sergeant Slaughter, this is a big guy. I mean, they could have gotten a series out of Andre out of him, but they just didn't talk about it.
Yeah, the guy, again, he's another guy. He's much better heel.
Slaughter, I can see, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he finally had the match with Slaughter. It would have been too late. But I could see a match with him, say, like 80. Did he ever run with Hogan when he had the belt? I mean,
not in the 80s, no.
Yeah, because they would have been both in faces. That's right. See, that would have been a nice. See, they should have flipped him right there. That would have been a nice match, I think.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Back then, say right after he wins, that would have been an outstanding match, especially the way Sarge bumps. He'd be all over the place for Hogan.
The WrestleMania match with Hogan versus Slaughter I thought was good. Not great, but good. And they had this Desert Storm match in Madison Square Garden, summer of 1991, and it was outstanding.
Oh, so yeah, Sarge could always go, but he had that vibe in the early 80s. Just, I mean, the early 80s with in New York, WWF, and he just had a really nasty kind of feel to him. He just, I think they misused him. I think he just would have been a fantastic. Why would you use him as a face? Is it they needed a second tier guy for the second shows? He just seems a more natural heel to me.
I, you know what? But Snuka and Slaughter are like the same guy when it comes to this. They were, in my opinion, artistically both better as heels, but from a promotional standpoint, obviously, if it's, fall 1982, time to turn Jimmy Snuka. The way when Hogan first came into the WWF and he finished his feud with the Iron Sheik, Sergeant Slaughter versus the Iron Sheik was the most natural feud I could imagine.
I guess I could definitely see him having a very good series with Hogan. What about here's one, since I'm thinking of Snuka as a heel. What about flipping Jimmy?
Like in 84, 85?
Yeah.
No, I thought the fans were too invested in him by that point, and obviously,
yeah, but that
by
makes
that
the best
point,
heel turn.
One of these days, I'll get into this big like pro wrestling philosophy thing, but I don't. But I believe there are some guys that just should not be turned, because if you do too many turns, the more turns you do, the less effective they are.
Well, that's true, but Jimmy hadn't been a heel in it's been a couple of years. So, I mean, he's been a babyface for a little bit. I just think if you have that great passion for a guy, that passion will carry over the other way. And it'll be it'll be like the Scorn lover,
Maybe.
Like, I had faith in you and you did this. I'll give you an example. We've had this discussion several times. The what if Harley no-showed Starrcade 83? Okay? And what would you have as the main event?
If it was me, I know exactly what I would have done. Dusty Rhodes was in the building.
Mm-hmm.
I would have said Harley Race did not show up for the event. I would have pulled a Watts, something like he's too scared to show up. So Harley has been stripped of the belt, and we are having Ric Flair versus Dusty Rhodes as the number one versus number two contender match, and I would have had Dusty win it.
I've heard that story, and I've heard you tell it, and mine has always been Orton. He was the good
Orton
guy, Rick's buddy. You don't have Harley. Who's the next best thing? The traitor. They hated Bob, and I mean, I think he's fantastic, but I mean, that was that heel turn, and that was because they liked him so much to start off with. And then when once they flipped him, there was hate because of
you
that
know
reason.
What, though? If too many baby faces break the fan's heart, the fan's going to turn the channel. He's not coming
back
to the arena.
That's fair. It has to be done with the right guy. I agree with that. You can't do it all over the place.
The right guy was Larry Zbysko. I couldn't think of a more perfect guy to turn than Zbysko. It was so well done.
How did that get pitched?
My understanding, it was something that Bruno and Zbysko had in mind for a while. And it depends on who you talk to. But if you look at the Shea Stadium match, the cage with Bruno and Larry, Larry raised Bruno's hand at the end. And he kind of, you're the better man, whatever. Not a very heelish thing to do. And a long time ago, someone told me that this was all going to unfold in a scenario where Zbysko somehow turns back babyface and becomes WWF champion, and he is the new Bruno officially. And I don't know how we get there. I don't have those details, but I know someone in the business a long time ago told me that was on the board, and Vince Sr. scratched it, and that's one thing that caused a major rift between the San Martino Zbysko camp. If you notice, Bruno wasn't around much longer after that, and neither was Zbysko, and the McMahon camp.
Yeah. Play that out. Okay, say there's not a riff. Say they do what you think they're going to do with Larry and what Larry thought they were going to do with Larry. How would that play out? Would that work?
Hard to say. I mean, you're putting some risk out there because Zbysko was so hated. But then again, if Bruno forgave him and Bruno endorsed him, I think the fans might have taken him back.
Maybe. You think he would have got a run with the belt?
I mean, that's what they were talking about. They were talking about Backlund being replaced by Larry Zbysko and Larry kind of being the new Bruno.
Now, I've heard that you had an opportunity to ask Larry about this personally.
I did, but well, we're going to get to that one in a minute. I actually met Larry Zbysko a couple of times, and I never brought up the thing we're going to be talking about later. But anyway, speaking of what ifs, well, we're going to do this as a regular segment, maybe not every single show, but I think it's always interesting to ask the what if question. Now, before we ask this what if question, we have to pretend that we can solve all of the problems that led to Gino Hernandez's death before it happened. There's been talk that Gino had a serious drug problem. There has been also been talk that Gino was not accidentally overdosed. He pissed off the wrong people, ripped off the wrong people maybe, and they gave him a lethal dose of cocaine via an injection. I know someone personally who has interviewed a bunch of Gino Hernandez's friends, and they told him that Gino had, I don't know what you call it, but that thing where you're deathly afraid of something, and Gino was afraid of needles. And they were like, there's no way Gino put a needle into his own arm. So
needle phobia.
There you go. Needle phobia. We'll go with that one.
Yeah, as the Greeks
call
it.
What do you think would have happened had Gino's problems all magically gone away and he had not passed away February 1986?
Well, here's my problem with Gino. Again, great vibe. And a little undersized for the era. But my problem was, he just, in the ring, he seemed really, as much charisma as he had, he seemed really clunky. Like, oh, that finisher. Oh, the elbow off the top that he used to run out there with.
Yes.
Oh, it was the worst thing ever. I mean, the way he would do it is he would be, back to the wrestler, and he would just basically fall backwards onto the guy and drop an elbow. It looked terrible.
It was not graceful.
I just didn't think he didn't look fantastic in the ring to me. I mean, when I see the dynamic duo, I think Tully, as far as the in-ring guy. He's like the Adonis of the team, and then Ventura is more kind of Gino. I mean, Gino's better than Ventura, obviously, because Ventura's just terrible. But, I just never thought he was that great in the ring. I'm not sure where do you think his ceiling is? I mean, maybe like a TV champion on NWA?
Well, here's the thing. Geno, to me, is one of the most interesting what-if scenarios out there, because he could have gone really high or he could have gone really low. We'll start with the really low. I think had Geno... it's very possible that had Geno not passed away, he would have been one of the 8 or 9 guys who left World Class right after the Texas Stadium show and headed to Mid-South. Now, that's not too bad on its own, but then when Watt sells the company maybe, 8 or 9 months later, he basically ignored every single one of those guys. And it's entirely possible to see Geno just kind of wasting in Crockett's new UWF for the rest of 1987 and landing back in Dallas and staying there the way Chris Adams did, which was kind of a shame.
I guess. I mean, do you think he gets over in Mid-South, Geno?
Yes, I do. Especially because, Mid-South, pretty much that entire territory got the world-class television. So he was already established as a top heel.
And he's another guy that, like, kind of like we were talking about Brody last week, and similar to Brody in that I think the places where he had the highest appeal were beginning to die out a little bit.
That's actually a really good point. That happened to the Freebirds, too.
Yeah, I mean, you know, once Georgia, once all those places where you're uber hot, and, you know, they all start, because he was huge in Texas.
One thing about Geno, and I talk about getting back to wrestling philosophy, if you're a wrestler, never let them call you a junior heavyweight, because you will have that stigma forever. Like the WCW guys in the 90s were scared to death to be stuck in the cruiserweight division because everyone treated it as kind of a joke. I mean, we all liked the matches, but we knew these guys weren't the main event. Geno was the Georgia junior heavyweight champion for a while. And it was like, no matter how big he got, he couldn't get out of that rabbit hole. But I saw him wrestling Kerry I watched a match recently from 1985, and Kerry was a little bit bigger than him and than Geno, and he was definitely better defined. But like shoulders wise, Geno was in his range. You know what I'm saying? Like Kerry is probably 10% bigger than Geno Hernandez.
Oh, absolutely. Your what you said about the junior heavyweight remind me of a promo. This was actually a promo that Billy Dundee did. Probably around 80, 81, somewhere in there. And he just beat Stan Lane for the U.S. Junior Championship, whatever it was they made up. And Lance asked him, he goes, I didn't know you were competing for the Junior Heavyweight Championship. And Bill basically explained, yeah, I don't want the stigma. I had the opportunity, I went for it, but I didn't want that stigma because I got to go out there with the heavyweights. So Bill basically did a promo on what you just said about Geno.
That's funny. Now, here's another scenario Geno could have wound up with. Tully Blanchard was trying very hard to get him to leave Dallas and come in as his running partner in Crockett. Now, let's say Geno had said yes to this right around May of 1986. Let's say Geno said, after the Texas Stadium show, I'll come to Crockett, and they knew like a few weeks in advance. We could have seen a scenario where the Four Horsemen never existed.
It I was going to say that, yeah.
Geno and Tully as the dynamic duo, and that's going to be one heel faction, and then you would have the Minnesota Wrecking Crew of Flair and the Andersons as the other heel faction. Let's not talk about Paul Jones' Army.
Yeah, see, that's a more interesting scenario because I think the dynamic duo, that's just one of those teams that clicked. Just the size, the way, you know, Tully was the better guy in the ring, I thought, by a good amount. Geno kind of had that superstar charisma to him.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think that could have worked. And I could see them as the tag team champions, say, you know, late 84.
Yeah, I could absolutely see that. You know, I mean, and I have the feeling, though, that they would have been more than just a tag team. They would have been a heel faction like they were in Southwest.
Well, would you just have it those two, or would you put somebody else with them? Reverse the trend.
Quite possibly, or maybe we could have had the Five Horsemen. I don't know.
Well, I mean, what if that is, I mean, say, what if it's, I don't know, take, what if you use them as the four horsemen instead of the, I don't know, how else would you do that, I guess, if you put them in as a unit for the four horsemen? I don't know who
okay,
to take
this
out.
Just jumped into my head, and it's the most obvious thing in the world. The four horsemen are the Andersons, Tully Blanchard, and Gino Hernandez. Ric Flair doesn't need the horsemen. He's brought down by the horsemen.
Oh, no, yeah, the horsemen was there to springboard everyone else.
Yeah, but it was like Rick, it was like being in that gang, I thought, sometimes de-emphasized Flair. It took away from him.
And it also gave Dusty a million and one ways to have Rick disqualified.
Yeah, really. You got to have our priorities here. So,
Rick did not need him. No.
No. And, you know, like I said, I felt like when I was at the Great American Bash in 1989, and I saw Terry Funk, you know, walking to the ring with Gary Hart, we all kind of said, oh, no, you know, nothing against Gary Hart, just Terry Funk didn't need him. And every time Terry's on TV, he's going to be sharing space with Gary Hart, and he just didn't need that. I thought Terry Funk needed to be by himself.
Oh, absolutely, because Terry's his own animal. I mean, just the way, you know, just the whole act. I mean, that thing that Terry does, I mean, it just carries over everywhere, whether it's in the ring, the, you know, the interviews and everything else. It's just like one big thing. And anything else interferes with it. Why would you put Gary with Terry? What was the reasoning behind that? You were hooked up back then. You know guys from back then.
My guess is that Gary Hart just politicked his way into the main event feud.
Or could it be one of those things where Gary's the one who kind of brought him in because of an old contact?
I'm pretty sure Gary didn't bring him in. I do know that Gary, I don't think at the beginning of the push, but certainly when the push started, he was legitimately representing Great Muda. So that might have been how he slid into that, because they were going to do Funk and Muda against Flair and Sting. So that makes sense.
Yeah. But, okay, I'm straying, but back to your original point about Gino, because this one interests me now, because I always liked them as a tag team. I thought they were fantastic. What do you say? Okay, so eventually you're going to have to split them. Say, you know, so how does that play out? Say they go to Crockett.
I mean, you don't necessarily have to split them, but, I mean, we talked about this before. I thought they made a mistake turning Chris Adams in World Class on Gino instead of the other way around. I thought Gino should have been the babyface. In this scenario, Gino absolutely has to be the babyface in Crockett, because Tully, you cannot push him as a babyface. I'm sorry.
No. What would that even look like? I can't even imagine.
I saw it in Southwest. It didn't look good.
Okay. I never actually. Well, yeah, but that was when he was with Gino, right?
No, this is when Gino was gone from the business for about a year. They did an angle, and this was like towards the very end of their run on USA Network. They did an angle where the Sheepherders attacked Joe Blanchard, and Tully obviously turned babyface as a result. Another possibility with Gino is him simply going to the WWF and them doing whatever they're going to do with him. You know, put him in a pretty boy babyface tag team, maybe, as maybe he would have been the you know, it could have been Rick Martel and Gino Hernandez as the Can-Am connection.
What year are you talking about here?
I am talking the Can-Ams came in fall of 86.
I think they would have buried him. If he went, with the size, they would have buried him. If he went to New York.
Maybe, but you know what? You look at the Undertaker when he first came in to WCW in 1990 as one of the skyscrapers. He was too small when they brought him in. About a couple, maybe 6 weeks later, he wasn't too small anymore, if you know what I mean.
I guess, but you'd have to – him too heavy would look weird. I think the better course for him is Crockett. And even then, where do you max him out, say he plays out of Crockett? I see him as like a U.S. title contender, maybe.
Definitely. I can't see why not.
Yeah, but I can't see him getting any serious. Maybe like the Ricky Morton, you know, during the Great American Bash title shot, you know, something like that. But I can't see him getting a serious run.
A serious run against Flair and Crockett for the belt. They did it with Jimmy Garvin. They did it with Ronnie Garvin. They did it with Brad Armstrong.
Yeah, those are your examples.
Unfortunately, yes.
I mean, Ronnie, and I'll defend the Ronnie one till the end, because, again, I think they put him in a bad spot. And if they did that a year earlier, that match makes perfect sense. Because, like, you know, that was the year, as we were talking about last week, that Ronnie and Tully decided to beat the holy hell out of each other on TV with that fantastic match.
Yeah.
But, I mean, yeah, all three of those failed. Yeah, first of all, Garvin should never be getting a run at any title. I mean, it just talk about bad.
Oh. Is it Jimmy we're talking?
Yeah. Oh, Ronnie, I liked. Jimmy was. I never remember Jimmy being good in the ring ever, even in Texas.
I thought he was good in World Class. Jimmy was one of those guys, and you hear this almost too much about different wrestlers. I always hear about Brad Armstrong. He was one of those guys that was way funnier away from the camera than he was on camera. And, I mean, I can attest that. Jimmy might have had the funniest interview of all time. It was on Worldwide Wrestling in, I want to say, May or June of 86. And he calls Wahoo McDaniel on the phone. And he goes, "Hi, can I speak to Wahoo? Yes, this is David Crockett." And Jimmy looks at Crockett. He goes, "I got to say it's you, otherwise he won't come to the phone." I'm just dying.
Oh, I didn't mind him as an interview. He has Tony Garea disease in the ring.
Oh,
I can't be bothered. I'll get
fatal.
2 minutes into it. I'm like, oh, he's just so boring. Yeah, but the promos are fine. I mean, he did the famous bit in, and he's a good sport about stuff, which helps. He did the famous bit in Florida with Carl Cox, where Cox was trying to get him into shape, and he was basically, you know, he was the Marine sergeant, and Jimmy was the recruit. I mean, that was funny. So he does that stuff well. He got roped into a million things in Dallas.
You know what, though? When he was in Florida, for a long time, like, he had that 79 run with the Florida title, and the, you know, Killer Carl Cox turned on him. And after that, he kind of, I don't want to say disappeared, but he wasn't in a main event spot anymore. He was an undercard guy in Georgia. He was an undercard guy in Mid-South. And then when he went back to Florida, he was an undercard guy again until they matched him up with J.J. Dillon and the original Sunshine, and they gave him the Gorgeous Jimmy act. I don't think he would have – Jimmy Garvin wouldn't have been in the business too much longer had he not found that.
Well, okay, let me describe Jimmy this way. Jimmy's kind of like the Dustin Pedroia of wrestling. If you put him in the right spot, in the right situation, the right atmosphere, and everything's right, he'll do fine. If all those elements aren't there, then you're going to run into trouble.
I can definitely see that. You know, and I mentioned I was lucky enough that I had met Jimmy Garvin. We're going to have a segment based on the old David Letterman show. David would have people come on and talk about how they would just bump into an odd celebrity and there would be a funny moment. Sean, I know you've met a wrestler or two, right?
At the urinal. At the urinal, the Waltham IBEW. I'm sitting there minding my own business, and who walks up? Jim Fullington himself, the Sandman. In full regalia, Zubaz pants, Singapore cane, and he leaned up against the wall. Nice
to
do that.
He had the cane with him.
Absolutely.
He took it to the right.
Yes, he did. And then we're sitting there for a second of silence, and he turns around to ask me, he goes, yeah, where's the nearest packy? You know, meaning the nearest, you know, the nearest liquor store. Probably didn't. But for some reason, in my Boston accented mind, it comes out that way. But yes, it's, of course, I mean the liquor store. So I was like, yeah, it's right down the street. And that was my great meeting with the Sandman. But in ECW, ran into that all the time. There was, I used to tell you a while ago that I had an incident over in the Webster Town Hall. This is probably late 96. And I was over there for an ECW event. The town hall basically was your standard town hall, and they had a little bit of an auditorium for town meetings. You could probably fit 600 people in it, maybe. And the main event was Sandy and Raven. So they had some kind of crazy stipulation. I forgot what it was.
And
they ended up brawling out of the ring, past the stands, and now we're thinking they're going outside. Nope. They turn around, and they go right into the office area of the town hall. So they're basically picking up like ash cans and throwing them at each other, going up and down past the comptroller's office, the vice mayor or whatever. Yeah, and finally, I could still hear this woman's voice. This little woman pokes her head out and goes, "Take it outside." I was like, "Really? That's your answer? You have these two lunatics, one in the Zubaz pants, and the other guy looking like the he just came off the Slacker tour in Seattle, just brawling and throwing stuff, bleeding everywhere." You figure they call the cops, but.
Okay, and just so everyone knows, a tacky store is a term used in New England. As everyone knows, Boston is a big college town, unlike, what the guys from Spinal Tap say. And back in, like, the 70s and 80s, you could purchase alcohol at the age of 18. That changed in, like, 79. It went from 18 to 20. But you couldn't bring visibly, you couldn't like make it obvious that you were bringing alcohol into a dorm room. So you had to have this giant package to put the alcohol in, the beer, whatever you're getting. So that's where that term came from. But anyway.
Yeah, it's a package store.
But yeah, well, everyone calls it a packy store down there. They still do.
Right, right.
Anyway, yeah, I had an interesting brush with greatness. This was in 1985. And I am getting gas with my girlfriend. And we're getting back in the car. We went inside for something. We get back in the car. And I hear this male voice go, "Hey, is it pump or pay first?" And oh, by the way, look out, people. There's some profanity coming in this story. And I close the door, and I don't hear what's going on for, like, I don't know, 4 or 5 seconds. And all of a sudden, I hear her screaming, "Fuck you!" at this guy. And he yells, "Fuck you," back. And she goes, "Fuck you, you fucking asshole." And I'm like, what is going on here? So I get out of the car and I look, and it's Larry Zbysko and my girlfriend in this like incredibly heated argument for no apparent reason. And I just look at him, and so for really, I had never, met or talked to a pro wrestler before. I had, looked at Steve King when he was pumping gas in North Attleboro 6 years ago. But yeah, I'm like staring, like I'm like ready to yell at this guy, "Hey, you don't yell at my girlfriend," or whatever. And I look, and I'm just like, "Oh my God, Larry Zbysko." And she's like, "You know this fucking asshole?" And Zbysko, I'm like, "Larry, how you doing? Ignore her. How are you?" And he just like waves his hand at me in the most disgusted manner possible and like walks back to his car. What happened is, what I didn't hear was he just says, "Hey, pump or pay first?" And she's like, "What? Pump or pay first?" And that's like what got her going. Because Larry's not mindful about the way he speaks to people. I've been around Larry a couple of times.
Making Friends and Influencing People by Lauren Zbysko. Such a charmer.
There was a show at the Ice Arena in Tingsboro, Mass., which I forget why, but I was not going to. And that's what Larry was doing around here.
Oh, boy. So, like, what you okay, which run would that have been for Larry again? Is he just kind of... Was he doing was he kind of working the local scene then, or?
No, he was working the local scene here in, I went to see a show at St. Stan's in Nashua in 1982, and we actually got front row seats for the show, which I was really excited about. I'd never had front row seats to a pro wrestling event in my life. Well, it turns out everyone had a front row seat for that show, and they were empty front row seats as well because about 40 people went to this thing. This was 1985 when he was part of the AWA/Pro Wrestling USA, and they were trying to make inroads basically into everywhere. But they had a show at the Walter Brown Arena where in BU. I think this was right around that time, probably like the next day or the day before that show.
Okay, so I was trying to wonder if that was back when he was in the wilderness there for a couple of years.
Yeah,
that after WWF.
From the time he left the WWF, which I want to say was March or April of 1981.
Until Georgia?
He debuted in Georgia, which was right around January, February of 1983. Yeah, Larry Zbysko was on a milk carton for about a year and a half.
An underrated run. I know you don't like it, but I think that was more a fault of the rest of the card. because it started to fall apart by that point. But I like Larry in Georgia.
You know what? I liked Larry in Georgia. I did. He did a great interview. I thought he was a great promo. The problem was you needed stars in Georgia surrounding Larry so that Larry looks like a star, as opposed to it looked like Georgia just hired all the guys that couldn't get jobs elsewhere. And that's pretty much what happened. And even if those guys were talented, you know, Ron Garvin hadn't been in a major promotion in how long? Pez Whatley, same thing. Killer Brooks, same thing. You know, they invented the Road Warriors. They brought up Arn Anderson from Continental, and he wasn't very good at that point. Mr. Wrestling 2 was old. Tommy Rich was washed up. You know, they just didn't have – they needed someone for Larry Zbyszko. He needed to be part of, like, a major league promotion, which at that point Georgia kind of wasn't.
Well, I think Ronnie and Larry would have worked nicely, actually.
They did work a couple of times.
Did they?
I'm pretty sure there was a Garvin versus Zbyszko match at the Omni for the national title. And I know they wrestled on TV.
Because that would have been a good matchup, because Larry was kind of the stall, Larry Stall kind of cowardly guy. And then on the other end, you'd have Ronnie, and Ronnie, even more than 87, was the bad, you know, he was a bad dude. I mean, he was just coming off of that run in Continental where he was killing everybody. You know, that's when he, you know, beat the crap out of Andre. So, I mean, he had this real tough guy rep by then. He ended up with a nice feud with, was it Roberts?
He had the feud with Jake Roberts, which was interesting to say the least. Think about this. Larry Zbyszko bought the National Heavyweight Championship from Killer Brooks for $25,000. Here, Larry, here's the championship and the belt. Right after that, they run an angle where Ronnie Garvin has to pay Paul Ellering and Jake Roberts $35,000, not for the title itself, but just for a title shot.
How much is the champion making? I mean, seriously, I mean, you got to figure you got to be close to taking a loss at this. I mean, back then, you know, you're the national heavyweight champion. You can't be making enough to override $25,000 a year. My God.
That was one of the great mysteries to me growing up. How much money do the pro wrestlers make? Before the New Jersey Meadowlands show I attended in 1984, we ran into Bill Apter and Craig Peters from Pro Wrestling Illustrated. And that was kind of the first thing we wanted to know. Like, we knew how much the baseball players made. We knew how much the football players made, basketball, et cetera. It was right in the sporting news. Wrestling did not mention a word about how much the wrestlers made, or if they were married, or if they had kids, but that's beside the point. And that was the first thing we went after, like, what do these guys make? And I forget exactly how Apter dodged that subject, but he dodged it.
I have a kind of an off-the-cuff question for you. It's a philosophical wrestling question. You haven't once owned your own promotion. I think you could help me out here. Define to me, like, if you're a promoter, if you're booking something, and you're coming up with some kind of angle for, you know, however much money match, what number do you go with where it looks like, wow, this is a big deal, but doesn't get to the point of, okay, stop it?
I go with...
Because that's a fine line.
Fair. What's that?
I said, that's a fine line.
It really is. It's something that I have put thought into, going from one extreme to another. I have some really old, like, Gulf Coast wrestling from, like, 72, 73, and the wrestlers, Cowboy Bob Kelly and someone else, got into this giant bloody brawl, and they made an announcement. Both of those wrestlers, they got fined $25 each. Now, that, okay, I get it, the $25 carried a lot more buying power than it does now back then.
That's
money.
I
really think even as a kid, $25, I would have been like, okay, you know, if these guys are really superstars that make money, you know, that's vending machine money to them. On the other extreme, and this was so dumb, in 82, and I think it leaked into 1983, in Mid-Atlantic Wrestling, Dory Funk Jr. was doing an angle where if a wrestler beat him in the first 15 minutes of a match, that was $100,000.
Yeah, Paul Jones says this as he's wearing the rental. Nice job, Paul. You know, like, buy your own tux before you start throwing around $100,000, all right? And how about getting a couple of decent wrestlers while you're at it? You know, while you're at the store, you know, why don't we not bring out T-Joe Khan and the rest of the crew, all right? Just go get yourself someone decent. That was, I remember seeing that, you know, I actually just saw those episodes probably a few weeks ago. And, you know, and Dory looked great. It was a perfect use of Dory. You know, you had Paul to cover for him, and that was fine. But then they got to this 100,000 thing, and then it would go, like, go on and off. They would forget about it for a time, bring it back up again. No, that was not one of their better ideas. So,
I mean, you could have bought two nice houses in 1983 for $100,000. So I'm thinking that figure is a little bit excessive. One of the great things, though, and I'm going somewhere with this, they did an angle in Georgia where Michael Hayes won Robert Fuller's car. Robert Fuller put up his brand new 1980 Lincoln Continental in a match. And they were talking about that car cost $17,000. Based on that, I think the perfect number from old school wrestling, whether it be a bounty angle, a battle royal, you win the tournament, this is the cash amount you get, is the amount of a nice car.
Yeah, that makes sense. I just thought of this story, and I know you're going to know something about it. The time Austin Idol cashed a check.
Yes, I heard about it on Arcadian Vanguard, no less, on Austin Idol's show. They gave him an oversized check when he won something, and he just went to the bank like nothing was going on, and he cashed it. And he figured, you know, the worst that would happen is they would say, you know, sorry, Mr. Idol, we can't cash this check. But instead, he gives him the check, and they come out with the cash. The promoter's screwed.
Did he actually bring the big – did they give him, like, the big check, the cardboard thing?
If I recall correctly, that's exactly what the story was.
So there's Austin Idol standing in line at the Bank of America with this 3-foot by 3-foot whatever check.
Yeah,
getting ready to cash it. That's my visual here.
That is my understanding of exactly what went on.
God bless wrestling. That's all I got to tell you. That's, you know, where else are people like this going to get a job? Oh, that is fantastic.
I have two more, I think, good, like, wrestling money stories. When Scott Hall was in the NWA, this is in 1989, like, we said hi to him, and Scott Hall is telling us, remember Vern Gagne had $1 million battle royals?
Yeah.
This is like in 85, 86, 86, 87-ish, I want to say.
Yeah, and 300 people in the stands.
But $1 million is going to the winner, exactly.
Makes perfect sense.
Off the subject, I went to an indie show in 87, and they announced a $10,000 battle royal, and there had to be like 60 people there. It was insane. But anyway, yeah, and Scott Hall is telling us about all of the cool stuff he bought with his $1 million, excuse me, that he won in the battle royal. And we're like, you know, okay, dude, come on. We're kind of, you know, a little bit smart to the business. It's okay. And he just kept rambling on about the shit that he bought. Oh, yeah, I bought a condo on the beach in Florida, and I got my dream Jeep. He's just going on and on. It was insane. The second one, this is where I don't know why Vince McMahon picked on Vern Gagne so badly in the wrestling war. I mean, he went after AWA guys. It didn't matter what you did in the AWA, the WWF was going to hire you. They hired Ron Trongard, for God's sake. And just all of the AWA wrestlers pretty much that were worth anything wound up in the WWF.
Well, give you two quick reasons why that may have been. One is obviously because they got Hogan. So all Hogan's buddies are AWA guys.
Maybe.
That's one. Two, which makes the $1 million battle royal so ridiculous, is what was Vern known for?
A pretty straightforward product, I think.
By that point, they were kind of underpaying guys, weren't they?
by the time these battle royals were going on, I personally know a wrestler who was working there that was losing money. He was dipping into his savings to make ends meet on road trips.
Yeah, you weren't getting wealthy unless you were Nick Bockwinkel. You weren't getting wealthy in the AWA, possibly. Unless you were one of, like, one of Burns' guys.
Bockwinkel was swimming in money, but go ahead.
That, and they only had half a year schedule, too. So that may have probably presented a problem. I mean, Nick made enough where it wasn't a big deal, and he could pick up dates in Memphis. But I could see where poaching could be a possibility in the AWA.
Yeah, true. But the other story was Vern had... I'm trying to think if it was like a regular, like $20,000 battle royal. I think it was. I think this was before the days of the $1 million battle royal. I think it was like a $20,000 battle royal. And Vince calls the State Athletic Commission and the Internal Revenue Service, and he lets them know that this is going on. And I forget who won the battle royal. I think it was Crusher Blackwell who won it. And he gets backstage, and there are IRS agents waiting for him, ready to take the government's share of that $20,000 or $25,000, whatever it was.
That is so sadistically brilliant.
Vince didn't do that to anyone else. He just singled out Vern. When Vern was having his little pay-per-view in 1988, Vince tried to get Kerry kicked off the card because there was some rule in the Illinois State Athletic Commission had where you could not wrestle or box if you had a prosthetic limb.
Oh, that's a cheap shot too. Yeah, Vern deserved that one. You know, I'm sure Crusher would have claimed all that anyway on his taxes. I have no doubt.
No, my understanding was that as far as like the Blackwell thing goes, they just convinced the IRS that, no, this is a show. The wrestling is fake, and so is the money. Please don't ask me for $10,000 right now.
Oh, yeah. I could. First of all, I'm having – do you think the IRS completely bought that?
I kind of do, yeah.
Oh, I mean they would have – they would have had to. They would have bought the fact that wrestling is real, obviously. But, I mean, the whole thing, you're sitting there, if they're already there, okay? Because you have to figure, if they're going to sit, someone calls and they go, they have an event, a wrestling event at this arena, and they give him $20,000. Okay, they didn't laugh at him to begin with. So they actually went. I love that. They sent agents. They actually, your taxpayers' dollars right there. So they actually go. So they must have thought there was something going on. They're at a wrestling show again. They knew it was a wrestling show where they were going. So they must have thought something was up, and all of a sudden now Crusher comes up with the excuse, no, it's all fake. I'm sure they look at him like, okay. I mean, you normally would think, yeah, it's fake, but if you think about it, they went.
Yeah.
So they must have at some point thought there was something going on.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, the thing with the wrestling business is back in the day, and I remember this, I mean, before the day the Observer showed up at my doorstep, which I had been a wrestling fan for over 10 years at that point, the business was so shrouded in secrecy, and the magazines played along, okay? They did not expose the business at all. So you kind of didn't know, you knew the matches on TV were real, but we had people like literally saying, yeah, the stuff on TV is fake, but the stuff at the Boston Garden is real, because who would pay to see something that was fake? I literally had an adult tell me this.
Wow, that's some kind of self-justification right there. Who would pay to go see something fake? Well, you, for one.
Well, no, this is a person who didn't go to the wrestling match. As a matter of fact, it was someone who wasn't a fan at all. They were like, you know, you'll pay to see the fake stuff on TV, or you won't pay to see the fake stuff on TV, but who would pay to go see something fake at the Boston Garden? Like, you know, who would go see a play?
I'm kind of surprised a non-fan, because even back then, it was, you know, you got crapped on for that stuff. So, I mean, I'm surprised to even hear a non-fan even going that far to defend it. Yeah, I mean, even granting the arena show part is lie, you know, is real. Usually it's just like, oh, it's all crap, it's all fake.
Yeah. I mean, you know what? When it comes to wrestling, like being fake and, oh my God, you're so dumb for watching that, Harry White had the greatest analogy of all time. He said that, you know, people laugh at the crowds in wrestling getting all excited because something isn't real. Well, Gone with the Wind made people cry, and that wasn't a documentary.
Wrestling is the last bastion of vaudeville. It has everything. You have athletics, you have drama for what it's worth, you have comedy here, you have, you know, a good wrestling show will have, you know, a little bit of everything. You know, that's why I always liked ECW in 95, because they had all their cards had a little bit of everything. It's the last bastion of vaudeville. Yeah, so, I mean, it's, yeah, I always use the example of Indiana Jones with The Rock coming after him. You know, yeah, you really thought The Rock was coming after him? Still freaked out. I mean, meaning that the scene where The Rock comes flying down the mountain and goes right after, you know, and he's like, he just dies out of the way of time, in time or something like that. So, I mean, when you go to a movie, you're not sitting there believing that, but if you can just suspend disbelief for just a couple minutes, that's what the goal is. In wrestling, too, and in movies.
Yeah, I mean, two things. We're back to 1985 again. Me and my friends went to go see Rocky III, Rocky IV, the one where he fought the Russian. That's Rocky IV.
Four.
And we went to the theater, and, you know, they're having the fight. It's Rocky against Drago, and Drago's beating the crap out of him. And Rocky finally gets in that one good shot, and the crowd popped. And this isn't, you know, something I heard from someone else. I was there. The crowd popped when Rocky got that first good shot in. You know, I mean, it's me and my friends, when we went to go see wrestling, and this is when we were in our teens, probably leaked into our 20s too, we had a rule. Okay, we know this is all fake. We know that you can't get into a bloody fight with this guy tonight at the Boston Garden and do it again, Madison Square Garden, 2 days later. It's just not going to happen. That's just one example. And the rule was,
okay, but enough about that. So, John, we have about, like, say, we have a few minutes left. So how about this? Tell me about what is a show that either you went in thinking it wasn't going to be that good. It has to be a show you were at live that you didn't think was going to be that good, end up being really good, or the other way around that you thought was going to be great and was, you know, and this would be like a house show or something like that.
Yeah, the one that comes immediately to mind, my friends and I went to a show at the old Boston Garden, and this was November, it was fall 87, I want to say November, and the main event was Honky Tonk Man and Randy Savage. And, you know, Honky was not a particularly great worker. But at the same time, this turned into a really good show. They had the Islanders against Rick Martel and Tito Santana. And believe it or not, all four of them were working incredibly stiff with each other. And the Islanders were such an underrated tag team. They were so good, man. And it just, I don't know if I just, you know, wound up having a really good time at the event, which I did. But the wrestling was just way better than I thought it was going to be. Now, let me ask you, is there a show that you went into thinking this show was going to be a disaster and it turned out to be really good?
I'd say the Webster Town Hall one. You had – that was 86 – it was 96. I was beginning to sour on the product at that point. They were getting – it was – there was too much brawling in it at that point. So, because they back in the early, like say 95, the year or so earlier, you would have a little bit of something from each type. If you liked high flying matches, you'd have Rey Mysterio. If you like technical matches, you'd have Dean and Eddie. You'd have a couple brawls in there and a title fight. So, the Webster Town Hall, those shows were generally not awesome. So, but that
now,
show was,
this,
I mean,
you
had
you,
a...
Where are you living at this time?
At this point, I'm in Quincy. Webster's, I went to every show in Massachusetts.
Okay.
If they came, I went. So, they had the good main event, which was, that's what I always remember for, was the Sandy Raven one. But they had a tag team match in there with, it was actually kind of a loaded card. Because you figured this nothing show, and we had the Gangsters were there. And I believe the Dudleys were there too. And it was way – I've been to WWF shows kind of that you know, bigger than that, but that kind of small town. One I was in Stoughton, and I was a kid. It was 85, and the main event, I think, was this was a famously bad. Whenever you see, like, the worst listing ever for a card, this one comes up. It was in Stoughton High School, and the main event was Moondog Spot. And, yeah, this was the main event. It was the best match of the card, too, against, like, it's probably Greer after make fun of him all this time. It's probably why I've, like, you know, soured on him. But it was these two guys who you usually, if they were at MSG, they may be at, like, the bottom one or two of the card. Because this is 85. This isn't like 82 when the Moondogs are really over. You know, they were kind of at the end of the line at this point.
I think I've seen a listing for this show, and it was, I mean, it was every bit as bad as some of the shows they would have in, like, North Attleboro with, you know, Carlos Rocha in the main event against Doug Gashouse Gilbert. It was, I think I've seen this results from this show.
And this is the kind of the benefit of being the WWF at the time. You really could just throw out the banner. You know, they were that hot. I mean, you could get away with those cards.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing is, I think, you know, you have, I don't want to say hardcore, but, you know, lifelong dedicated wrestling fans such as you and I. And then you have the people, I'm not putting anyone down here, you know, hey, wrestling's coming to the high school, let's go. And, you know, they don't know who the stars are, and they really don't care. They're just there because something big has come to their hometown. I mean, Stoughton's not exactly Tokyo or anything.
No, I can promise you that. It's my hometown. It's definitely not Tokyo.
There you go.
But I found it. May 5th, 1985. Yeah. Let's see if this changes your mind. Ricky Sexton against Doc Butler. What is a Doc Butler?
It sounds like a shoe. I know Ricky Sexton lived around here, and he would just be a body. He was on that show in Nashua that had 40 people. So I know he was just a body that would come in, and, you know, if there was work, he'd take it.
Well, I know him. I'd never heard of Doc Butler before. Rick McGraw, okay, against Mr. X, who could be anyone. That's probably like a high school kid they dragged off the street.
I think it was Danny Davis.
Mr. X? In
yeah.
Stoughton? Oh, that may have been the real character.
No,
they probably didn't bother shipping him over.
No, I think Danny Davis was learning how to wrestle as Mr. X.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying.
By this point.
Damn. I wish I remembered the match. Mario Mancini, who I don't know, and I watched it a lot back then, fought the Prince of Fame to a draw.
Okay, Mario Mancini was a TV enhancement guy for a long time. He was pretty well known. I don't know who the other guy is.
Okay, hey, Paul Roma sighting defeated, of course, Pete Doherty. We can't have a card in Massachusetts without Pete Doherty on it. God forbid. The feature of the New England Sports Network Boston Garden broadcast, Pete Doherty. SD Jones against Moondog Spot. There's the match. That was easily the best match of the card. I remember that match. Because Spot's Larry's good. Larry's the goods in the ring. He is, I mean, you can't say enough good things about Larry Latham as far as I'm concerned. I mean, he's always good in the ring. And then here's the main event. No wonder I forgot this. George Wells against Mr. Fuji. Yeah, beat that.
I can't. Oh, my God.
My first wrestling card. You're looking at it.
This is 1985.
Yep, that was my birthday present.
Yeah, I mean, Fuji in 85 was done taking bumps. And I'm sure in his prime he wasn't going to take a bump in Stoughton. George Wells, for a guy who was athletic enough to play in the Canadian Football League, my God, he was so bad as a wrestler. It was like he had no athleticism.
Oh, he was like Mosca's kid.
Oh, yeah. I'm one of those people who thinks that if Mosca's kid had stuck to the business, not gotten such a big push before he was even remotely ready, if they had just...
He might have achieved mediocrity.
I mean, possibly.
I'm going to stop you now, okay, before you go crazy here, okay? I don't know if, like, the gas fumes are leaking. No, he was horrible.
But he was horrible because they gave him a push first in Florida and then in Mid-Atlantic. I mean, they didn't even put him out there as an enhancement guy for a couple of years, like they should have done. Just send him out to Portland with a fake name or whatever and let him learn his trade.
I'm still not buying it. Okay, at least what I saw, say, take Eric Watts. Okay?
Please.
Awful. But, I mean,
another
if I'm looking...
Another football player
yeah.
who was good enough to be the starter at the University of Louisville. And that's
quarterback.
Not easy.
Nope.
Yeah.
Starting quarterback. Good athletes. Promo was terrible. And if you really squinted when you're looking at a really bad TV, you could see where he could potentially be a wrestler in a few years if given a chance. I never saw that out of Boston. He looked terrible. He's like Bruno's kid. Another one was terrible.
Mosca, he had a good look. And you know what? I think the comparison is really good to Eric Watts because Eric Watts had never stepped in a ring before and he's getting this crazy push. And that was the whole problem with him.
Actually, you know who Mosca kind of reminds me of a little bit is Kelly Kinski. Kaniski.
No, Kaniski was never getting over no matter what, unless it was like in Vancouver, British Columbia, where his dad was from. He just had no charisma. Even if he could wrestle a decent match, which he occasionally could, the guy was white paint, man.
And Angelo Jr. did?
Yeah. Angelo Jr., I thought, had something. He had a good look. He had a good body. If they had just taught him how to wrestle, and he was Angelo's kid, so right there, you're over in Toronto. If they had just handled him correctly, I think he would have been, again, what was his upside? I mean, I'm not saying he was going to headline WrestleMania against Hogan, but I think he could have gotten a career out of it.
Oh, I think you need to check this guy out again. I respect your wrestling knowledge as much as anybody, but,
Do you know what
this is far worse than my goofy John Studd take.
Do you know what he did after his wrestling career?
I was hoping to forget him as soon as I could.
No, he was I guess he had a good reason not to hang out trying to be a pro
wrestler.
Oh, it's
going to make me sad for making fun of him, isn't it?
No! He became a lawyer!
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to say he had some horrible illness and I was going to feel terrible for ragging on the guy for 5 minutes.
No, I'll make you feel better. He was a tax attorney out of, I think, somewhere in Rhode Island. I think Providence. I mean, where else is there in Rhode Island? And something came up maybe 10, 15 years ago where he got disbarred. At least that's the story I heard.
I was going to say as a wrestler, he was a good tax attorney. I can't even say that. You took that away from me, too.
All right, we are not going to top that. That was a good one, sir. We will see all of you guys next week. And before I go, I want to let you know that this was a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Thank you for listening. Please tune in next week. Thank you, John.